Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Good evening, WNYC listeners and New Jersey Public Radio listeners. I'm Brian Lehrer. And if you've been binging on the impeachment hearing and its aftermath today, or if you are just living your regular life and are just ready to get the gist now, here we are all together at 8 o'clock at night, and this is not national coverage. This time it's just us. We'll have Andrea Bernstein from Trump, Inc., and AP White House correspondent Jonathan Lemire, and we'll take your calls, and this will be your chance to react out loud or ask a question about the confusing parts, and there are many confusing parts. But don't call yet. We'll tell you when, because first, in just a minute, we'll hear from a local member of Congress who is one of the questioners today. It's Sean Patrick Maloney, Democrat from the Hudson Valley, who's on the House Intelligence Committee, and here's what he did today. Maloney had this very interesting exchange with the witnesses, which we'll play for you now. In it, we'll hear President Trump's current ambassador to Ukraine, William Taylor, describe a very unusual encounter that he had with National Security Advisor John Bolton in Ukraine 1 month after the Trump-Zelensky phone call, and while military aid to Ukraine was still being held up to get them to investigate the Bidens in 2016. This two-minute clip begins with a question to Taylor from Congressman Maloney.
1 month later, on August 28th, you find yourself in Ukraine with the National Security Advisor, Mr. Bolton, right?
Yes, sir.
And you convey to him your concerns. You've testified to this previously about the withholding of military assistance. What does he say to you?
He says that he shares my concern, and he advises me to express that in a very special way to the Secretary of State.
Now, he's the National Security Advisor, works directly with the President, but he tells you that you should bring it up with the Secretary of State.
Yes, sir.
Have you ever sent a cable like that? How many times in your career, 40, 50 years, have you sent a cable directly to the Secretary of State?
Once.
This time?
Yes, sir.
In 50 years?
Rifle company banners don't send cables, but yes, sir.
So the National Security Advisor, who could tell it to the President himself and who shares your concern, says you, the ambassador serving in Ukraine, should cable the Secretary of State directly, and you do so, don't you?
Yes, sir.
What'd the cable say, sir?
It's classified cable.
Without going into classified information.
Without going into classified, it says security assistance, it's what we've been talking about today. Security assistance to Ukraine at this particular time, as in previous time, is very important. Ukraine, I also make the point that we've also talked about here today, Ukraine is important for our national security, and we should support it.
So
not to provide that would be folly.
Did you get an answer to your cable?
Not directly, no, sir.
Do you know what happened to it?
Secretary Kent.
Secretary Kent, do you know what happened to it?
Tells me that.
Yeah, I was on vacation when his cable came in, but my understanding is it made it to its recipient, intended recipient, Secretary Pompeo.
And we know Secretary Pompeo was on the call a month earlier on July 25th. It's not like he's in the dark about any of this. What do you do with it?
I honestly can't say for sure what happened with the cable once the message was brought in at the highest level.
That was Secretary Kent there at the end saying he doesn't know what his boss, Secretary of State Pompeo, did with the cable that Taylor sent him at John Bolton's request. With us now is Congressman Sean Patrick Maloney, Democrat from the Hudson Valley District that includes Poughkeepsie, Beacon, Newburgh, Middletown, and down into parts of Westchester. Congressman, thanks so much for some time on a very consequential day. Welcome back to WNYC.
My pleasure.
Let me ask you first about that exchange. Why did John Bolton, in his very lofty capacity as National Security Advisor, asked a lowly acting ambassador to Ukraine to send the Secretary of State a cable rather than just talking to Pompeo himself?
Well, that's a very good question. Of course, he could raise this issue directly with the president. Ambassador Taylor made clear that that John Bolton said he shared Ambassador Taylor's concerns that it was crazy to be withholding the military assistance from Ukraine, and instead he pushes him off towards the Secretary of State. And as you heard the ambassador say, one time in 50 years of public service has he sent a cable of that kind, and of course, Pompeo ignores him. So you have some combination of passing the buck or ignoring important information from a seasoned diplomat like Ambassador Taylor. There's really no good explanation except probably the president was hell-bent on this course of conduct, and people like Bolton and Pompeo were trying to sidestep it.
Or Bolton was being frozen out because the president figured he didn't support the policy. But Taylor then told you he never got a direct answer to his plea to support Ukraine for the sake of our national security, as he said. He said no direct answer. Do you know if he got some indirect answer?
His testimony was that he didn't receive an answer, and he doesn't know what happened to his cable. It's one of the things we'd like to follow up on. And I want to stress, I don't know. But it is part of a pattern of a very suspicious and disappointing conduct by the Secretary of State, who, after all, was on the July 25th call and, of course, neglected to mention that for days and days after, even when this whole scandal broke. He was on President Trump's call with the Ukrainians, the famous call, and now we learn that he's getting a very unusual cable from his ambassador in Ukraine sounding the alarm about this, and he ignores it.
Congressman, for people who didn't see or hear it today, can you describe or elaborate in your own words on the case that Ambassador Taylor was making for this military aid to Ukraine being important to our national security, not just Ukraine's? Because I think many Americans see this political football that the aid had become as being just a good deed for a threatened foreign country.
Yeah, thank you for asking me that, because I know that some of the people I represent wonder why this is important. We don't assume that people understand all the ins and outs of this, so let me just quickly explain. You know, Ukraine is on the front lines with the Russians. They are in an active shooting war right now with Russian forces in the eastern part of the country, and the Russians invaded and occupied the area of Ukraine known as Crimea in 2014. Ukraine right now is the difference between containing the Russians or allowing the Russians to rebuild an empire that moves into the heart of Europe. And so what happens in Ukraine has enormous consequences for the freedom and security of all of our allies in Europe, and of course the whole transatlantic alliance, which has kept the peace for 70 years since the Second World War. And then beyond all that, you know, Ambassador Taylor did and Secretary Kent today did an eloquent job of explaining that this is a young country with a tremendous future and a natural strategic partner for the United States, and they depend on us. And they are right now losing soldiers every day. They've lost 14,000 Ukrainian citizens on Ukrainian territory to Russian forces. They are on the front line of freedom. And the United States has learned this difficult lesson in the past, that if we don't stand with our allies at the moment they're threatened by a nation like Russia that is on the march, we will regret it. And of course, to fail to do so the president can accomplish some shabby personal political objective to get an advantage or even to spread a smear about a political opponent here at home makes it all the worse.
So how close is this to your case for impeachment in a nutshell as of now? That President Trump violated his oath of office by twisting U.S. foreign policy to serve his own personal advantage in a way that ran contrary to the national security of the United States.
Yeah, I don't agree. I don't disagree with a word of that, but I would put it slightly differently, which is to say, I just want people to ask themselves, if you're listening and you're undecided about this, ask yourself whether it can be okay for an American president, any American president, to go around the world using the power of his office and American taxpayer dollars to get foreign leaders to drum up investigations against American political opponents. I mean, just imagine if Barack Obama was pressuring the leader of India to start an investigation of Mitt Romney a few years ago, what these Republicans would have said. If he was withholding U.S. military assistance to further that objective, they would be crystal clear that is not just an impeachable offense, but something no American president can ever be permitted to do, because because it's so damaging to our democracy. So as a precedent, as something that we must take a stand against, I just can't think of anything more serious when you think about what it would mean. And if the Republican defense is, you know, so what? Yeah, he did it, but so what? Which I predict to you is where they'll end up. I just want to say, so what is where our democracy goes to die. It cannot be okay for this kind of conduct by a president of the United States. And that's why it's so important that the independent branch of government the founders gave us, the Congress, take a stand.
Then let me go even further down that road, Congressman, because I've been wondering, looking at your witness list for this week and next, how narrowly focused the Democrats' articles of impeachment might be on this one incident with Ukraine, as opposed to making a larger case that comes close to treason, that the president keeps tilting U.S. foreign policy to give aid and comfort to what Vladimir Putin wants, a weaker Western alliance so he can take more land in Europe, which the whole Western world thinks puts all our security at risk, and this is just one example of it.
Yes, I mean, I think you're getting at some very important issues that will form the heart of potential articles of impeachment. I don't want to prejudge what will happen when we submit a report to the Judiciary Committee, but if you're asking me, I think if you look at the Nixon articles of impeachment, you have a pretty good guide around the high-level issues of abuse of office, obstruction of Congress, and the like. And here, the abuse of office is what we've discussed, you know, using the presidency to try to smear a political opponent with foreign assistance. That just can't be okay. It cannot be okay for an American president to engage in that conduct. Our democracy cannot survive that type of conduct by any American president from either political party.
One of the main areas of pushback from the Republicans today was that the aid was not withheld, and the investigation, or it was restored anyway after a short time, and the investigations into the Bidens and the 2016 conspiracy theory were never launched. So since everyone backed down from this brink, even if it was corrupt to get that far, the ransom was never delivered and neither was the punishment. So it's a thin basis for the political death penalty, if you will, impeachment and removal. How would you respond to that?
Of all the arguments the Republicans make, this is one of the more head-scratching ones I've heard, because think about what they're saying. I mean, literally, we call it a whistleblower because when you blow the whistle, the play stops. In other words, the point of the whistleblower statute is to give a federal employee with knowledge of it, particularly in the classified context, a legal mechanism to stop the wrongdoing, to blow the whistle. That is precisely what happened here, and it is the only reason the evidence would suggest that the aid was released 2 days later, once three congressional committees were announcing investigations of this. In other words, the gig was up. And in addition, it's the only reason the Ukrainian president didn't actually give the interview to CNN that was negotiated with Giuliani that would have specifically started and publicly announced the investigation of the Bidens. In other words, the whistleblower stopped the wrongdoing. That is not to the president's credit. That is simply the way it's supposed to work, so we don't have to have the damage done to catch the wrongdoers. And that is the difference, perhaps, between a criminal conduct where you're trying to see an overt act. Here, we want that conduct stopped. They were going to lose these funds at the end of September. The Russians were literally waiting to see what would happen. And thank God the whistleblower did what he did. But none of that is to the president's credit. And the idea that the Republicans would try to use it as a defense is ridiculous.
We have just a few minutes left with New York Democratic Congressman Sean Patrick Maloney, a member of the Intelligence Committee, who is one of the questioners today. We have Ambassador Yovanovitch testifying on Friday, the one who was fired as ambassador to Ukraine, an alleged victim of this Giuliani, Mulvaney, et cetera, plot. Then more witnesses Tuesday through Thursday next week. Can you give us a sense yet of how much more you expect after that?
You know, I don't know. I think you're going to see the lion's share of the testimony that we need to present to give the public the facts they need this week and next. Whether it continues beyond that, I'm not prepared to say. I think but by the end of next week, the witnesses that we've noticed will provide, I believe, a complete accounting for what happened. But that's not to say that there aren't other very important sources of evidence. But remember, the State Department has refused to produce documents that have been subpoenaed. They've got a pile of notes from all these witnesses, emails, text messages, other corroboration. Everything Ambassador Taylor testified to today that he put in quotes is because he took a note about it contemporaneously. He is a copious note taker. Why don't we have those documents? Why don't we have the emails that will flesh this out? So there are other sources of information, but we are also mindful of the fact that we need to present a case now in public. We believe we have a complete set of information to understand how serious the president's conduct was and what went on here. But it doesn't mean we won't stop trying to bring more evidence to the public. And people like Ambassador Bolton and Secretary Pompeo and Mick Mulvaney need to say what they know as well.
Well, we have 2 minutes left, and I think the court case that would allow John Bolton to testify, if it goes the right way, probably can't get resolved before you'll have to vote on articles of impeachment. But according to other witnesses, Bolton, with his position and credibility, called the shadow Ukraine policy a drug deal and ordered it reported to a National Security Council lawyer. How crucial is a public role for John Bolton in particular in persuading enough of the American public that an impeachable offense happened here?
Look, we want Ambassador Bolton's evidence. Nothing is preventing him from coming to Congress as he has been requested to do and providing that evidence. We have heard from three of his deputies who managed to fulfill their legal obligations and get down here and do the right thing. Ambassador Bolton was negotiating a $2 million book advance while he was withholding his testimony, which almost certainly contributed to the size of the money he received to sell this story rather than provide it to the people's representatives in Congress. That's one of the most cynical and disgusting things I've ever seen in public life, and Ambassador Bolton should be ashamed of himself. But if he wants to come and testify, he sure does have important information. We need to hear it. He should get down here and provide it, and nothing is preventing him from doing so.
You think this is only about a lucrative book deal on Bolton's part? Because he doesn't seem to be on the president's side.
Look, I don't say he's going to be a helpful witness to the president. What I'm telling you is that I think it's outrageous that someone is negotiating a book deal for the same information, a book covering the same events, no doubt, that he is being called to testify on before Congress. And I don't have any idea how big a role that played in this, only that it was going on simultaneously. What I do know is that you've got an important witness who, unlike his deputies, three of them, who have exactly the same legal issues, who all came down here and testified truthfully and fully, he has refused to do so. That's not leadership. It's a cynical effort to delay. And that's how we interpret his desire to litigate this. And now to learn that he had a financial motive to do it as well just breeds the kind of cynicism I think we have too much of in American politics.
Congressman Sean Patrick Maloney, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
And now, listeners, we'll open the phones for your reactions to today or any questions about what happened for our guests, WNYC's Andrea Bernstein and AP White House correspondent Jonathan Lemire, who are both here in our studio. You can start calling at 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. We'll take your calls and keep explaining the day right after this. Brian Lehrer with you on WNYC with this 8 o'clock hour call-in special on this first day of the public impeachment hearings. Our number 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692 for your reactions or questions. As with me now are Associated Press, White House correspondent Jonathan Lemire, and our own Andrea Bernstein, co-host of the Trump Inc. podcast from WNYC and ProPublica, and author of the forthcoming book, American Oligarchs, The Kushners, The Trumps, and the Marriage of Money and Power. Hi, Andrea. Hi, Jonathan.
Hey, Brian.
Hello.
So, Jonathan, what's your biggest takeaway from today along this spectrum? Was it a newer, stronger case that Trump did something egregious, or was it basically the TV version of what's already been in the news? Because in terms of connecting with a larger public, a picture is worth a thousand words.
Well, first, I think it's important to take a step back and really set the stage here. This is only the fourth formal impeachment offering in the United States history. This is for the history books. This is a president who has tried to rewrite the rules of his office. He has cast aside norms. He's broken through guardrails on a daily basis. But now he is up against a constitutionally enshrined procedure that will limit his power, in which his fate in some ways is out of his own control. If there's the expectation that the House does move, controlled by Democrats, does move to impeach, even if perhaps the Senate, controlled by Republicans, will not remove him. So I think that is the backdrop here, and I think that shouldn't be lost. Even if people believe that the fate here is already written, that this is not going to remove him from office, this is still something that the American people should be paying attention to, and certainly Democrats feel like it is the right thing to do. As far as today's events, there were certainly some new developments. One in particular caught the White House off guard about a phone call, which I know we're going to get into a little later. I think it is more about the theater. It is about the visual today. To this point, this impeachment inquiry has largely proceeded behind closed doors. Opening statements would be released to the public. Lawmakers on both sides of the aisle would weigh in. But this is the first time that the Americans are hearing for themselves the case against Donald Trump, the case made that he, tried to extort the president of Ukraine, the Ukrainians, to find politically damaging information about a possible rival, Joe Biden. And I think that does carry some weight. For a lot of Americans, this is probably their first exposure to it, or their first real one. I mean, we certainly – I think TV sets all across the nation were tuned in today. And I think that is the most important thing today, is people are watching and paying attention and will now be focused on what happens next.
Andrea, same question.
What was really stunning for me today was the sort of drama. I mean, I've been reading a lot of the words on paper, but actually having people sitting in a room telling the story was really something. And, these are the sort of Washington bureaucrats that we never hear from. They live their whole lives and don't talk to us and don't particularly want to talk to us. So the fact that they were coming and testifying and answering questions, Bill Taylor, who spent half a century in public service, was really something. And that what they were saying was that there had been this bipartisan consensus that they were going to fight corruption in Ukraine because it was extremely important to the fate of the United States and the security of Europe that Ukraine be a healthy democracy, and that they were going to be committed to do this. And that instead of being able to bring rule of law government to Ukraine, what happened was that a government that doesn't seem to run by the rule of law began to trickle into our own democratic system.
Let's take a phone call. Charlotte in Manhattan. You're on WNYC. Hi, Charlotte.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. My question was, the other impeachment offenses and the dissembling of our democracy that's happening with the government now, will the public be able to hear in as much detail things like his immigration policy, separation of parent and child? And I think they might go under the articles of impeachment, but will the public be able to hear about it, which they really need to?
Thank you, Charlotte. It's a great question. And Jonathan, to one of the things in the Congressman Maloney interview, relevant to Charlotte's question, he seemed to acknowledge that he could make a case close to treason when I asked him about that word, weakening Ukraine and doing so many other things that seemed to strengthen Russia and weaken the United States. But he seemed to say they probably won't. They're more likely to make a narrow case on twisting our Ukraine policy for his personal advantage. Charlotte's raising other things, maybe emoluments, maybe putting children in cages. We could talk about authoritarian government, inciting people to violence with some of the things that he says. So how broad do you think the ultimate articles of impeachment might be?
Well, this is something that the House Speaker Nancy Pelosi has been wrestling with. She and the Democratic leadership of the House have certainly looked at the wide array of things that people who don't like President Trump might find impeachable. And the caller there mentioned a few, and there certainly can be others added to the list. To this point, though, they seem to want to proceed on a narrow track, that they feel like the most effective argument is to focus on the situation with Ukraine, that the broader it gets, perhaps the more confusing it gets. And I think that there are some people in Washington and on Capitol Hill who feel that Robert Mueller's special counsel probe, though vitally necessary and certainly uncovered quite a bit of wrongdoing, got confusing and almost was spread too thin and was hard to follow for your average American. A lot of difficult to pronounce Russian names, and the charges against Paul Manafort, though very serious, didn't have anything to do with Donald Trump. And I think that there was a sense here that they wanted to keep this as narrowly focused as they can. They feel like they've got the goods, that they don't need more than this, that this is, you know, the evidence they have, the testimony they have from the officials, this is impeachable, what the president did with his conduct with Ukraine, so therefore there's no need to go further.
But Andrea, further to Charlotte's question, you and your Trump Inc. podcast report on the intersection of Trump's private businesses and the public interest. And, you know, there's the hush money payments, potential tax fraud around that from 2016. There are other things that you're looking at. They will either go there or they won't.
Yeah. I mean, the indication is that they will not. Since the Democrats took over in January, they have instigated a number of investigations, and they have been met at every quarter by stonewalling, by refusals to testify, by not turning over documents, by lawsuits. Several House committees are in various lawsuits, some of them here in the Southern District of New York, to try to get the president's business records, his tax returns. Those lawsuits are working their way through the court system, but they still have not gotten the documents. So there is a sense that those investigations may not be productive. Whereas in this case, because of the whistleblower report and because of the release of that transcript, there's all this evidence that is out in the public record. And that seems to have been the trigger to have these witnesses who, you can read in their testimony, were instructed by their own State Department not to testify. And in fact, today, Bill Taylor acknowledged that he'd kept notes of everything that had happened in real time, and he had turned it over per protocol to the State Department, but the State Department has not turned it over to Congress. So even in this situation where they have a lot of information, they certainly don't have all of it. And I think that is the calculation that they're making.
A lot of our callers want to talk about Russia. Boris in Newark, you're on WNYC. Hi, Boris.
Hi. I think there is a story much bigger than impeachment. If you read the statement from George Kent, he mentions that there is a plan for Ukraine to become part of NATO. And we just celebrated the downing of Berlin Wall. And there was apparently a promise to Gorbachev that NATO will not move an inch eastward. And, of course, we now have Baltic republics, we have Poland, and all of the other people. And now we're talking about Ukraine. So Ukraine has a special relationship with Russia. It was part of Russia since like 17th century, except for the Western Ukraine, which was part of Poland. So now there's another thing that was interesting is that year 2014 was mentioned a number of times. So this is a time when the president Yanukovych was deposed. It was a time when Crimea was taken back by Russia. And it was also the time when Hunter Biden started his directorship. So all of this is kind of fits together. And my point is that, and by the way, this Congressman Maloney was just talking about the Russian aggression, and and I think it was mentioned during the impeachment hearing. It's really the United States that's an aggressor here. That's the United States that's moving toward Russia. And now we have a political class that's benefiting from it. And if there is a nuclear war, it's really the general public that will pay for all this.
Boris, thank you for your call. I think the case that Boris makes, Jonathan, is irrelevant to what's going on right now. However, it is an argument that progressives have among themselves. Did the U.S. kind of start the current tensions with Russia by trying to take a country like Ukraine, which has a big border with Russia, into NATO and into the EU? Imagine if the Russian bloc tried to do that with Mexico.
Sure. I think that is a backdrop here. But I also think there is the idea simply of let's narrow our focus a little bit toward the matter at hand.
Yeah.
Russia has always sort of been the shadow of this administration since the campaign, since day one. And there are a number of foreign policy decisions this administration has made, the president has ordered, that curiously seem to benefit Russia. And that has what has fueled talk on the left about what exactly is the president's relationship with Vladimir Putin, what exactly – what sort of financial ties might he have with Russia and so on. And that is, of course, the backdrop that the entire special counsel's investigation was set against. I think what we're seeing here, though, returning to the events of today, is that both men, but particularly Ambassador Taylor, who is an aside since we're on a radio show – tremendous radio voice, and yes, that was sort of one of the breakout moments of today. In fact, it was just that he is potentially going to host the hour after this. is that
he's going to have a podcast?
Yeah, that seems that seems
like
inevitable.
We're in contract talks. Yeah.
Excellent. That he really spoke in very vivid detail about the human cost of this deal, of this arrangement, that he described the Russian-backed militia forces across the bridge staring into Ukraine, the violence that has been there, talking about he and Deputy Secretary Kent both said the idea of that people have died. People are still dying in the contested regions there, and that's why it was so vital for the Americans to send this military aid to Ukraine, and how devastating the decision was by the president to delay it even for a short time.
Rob in Montclair, you're on WNYC. Hi, Rob.
Hi, nice of you to take my call. I'm calling to find out why none of the speakers in today's hearings, the questioners or the witnesses, made the connection between the constant claim of no quid pro quo and yet the significant evidence that there were conditions for Ukraine to receive certain benefits.
Right. And even beyond that, and I don't have this clip at hand, Andrea, but there was a moment where I think it was Ambassador Taylor described the phone call with Ambassador Sondland, who was kind of the go-between between Taylor and Trump, where Sondland said that Trump told him there's no quid pro quo, but these things are conditions of aid. Well, that is a quid pro quo.
Yes. I mean, I think that it's sort of like the up is down, black is white thing. I mean, what is so interesting about this statement by Sondland, and just to put this in context, so Sondland is a political appointee. He is a very large donor, $1 million donor to the Trump inaugural and the ambassador to the European Union. So he has played this role in it. But what really came out through the testimony today is these two, is that George Kent at the State Department and William Taylor, the chargé, as they continually refer to him because he has not actually been approved as ambassador, the chargé did not have access to Trump, even though they had maybe getting close to three quarters of a century in experience in foreign service between the two of them. Sondland, the newcomer, the Trump donor, did have access to the president. And he's the one who made a comment. It came up in the hearings today. Oh, Trump was just asking like a businessman. He wanted something before he wrote a check, which, as an aside, I should say that Trump almost never wrote the checks that he said he was going to write.
That's another story.
But Fair. Even so, this sort of transactional business view of things pervaded the relationship with the Ukrainian government. And I mean, this is the thing that we sort of look at all the time on our Trump Inc. podcast, is the cess of negotiation. So obviously, if you say to somebody, if you don't do something, we won't do something for you. You can call it whatever you want in Latin or any other language, but that is exactly what is at heart of the impeachment investigation.
We're talking about the impeachment hearing today with WNYC's Andrea Bernstein and Jonathan Lemire, AP White House correspondent. Our phones are open at 212-433-WNYC. Jonathan, the president wants Republicans in Congress to back him up on his claim that the July 25th call with Zelensky was perfect, his word, and that he did nothing wrong, as opposed to saying that holding military aid for a political favor was wrong, but not serious enough to be impeachable. How much did the Republicans on the committee today give the president what he wanted?
Well, the White House and Republican response throughout this entire impeachment inquiry has been scattershot and inconsistent, in part because the White House has sort of changed its narrative a few times as to what happened. The press briefing by Acting Chief of Staff Mick Mulvaney in particular was harmful to their cause of a few weeks ago. But yes, you were right. To this point, the Republicans really were fighting on process. They made a big deal out of the fact that these hearings were being conducted in secret. They made a big deal out of the fact that the hearings were conducted in the basement of the Capitol, ignoring the fact that that's simply where the secure room, the SCIF, is located. Those arguments have gone away now that we've moved into open hearings. They tried to replace that argument with saying, well, a lot of what we're hearing today is secondhand. It's hearsay, as they say. Now, we know certainly hearsay is admittable. It's useful in a court or proceedings like this. But it also raises the question, well, there are witnesses who could have firsthand testimony, the likes of Rudy Giuliani and Mick Mulvaney and Rick Perry. But the White House has blocked them from appearing. So they're sort of undermining their own argument there. The president himself, though Republican senators have started to say in particular, like, well, maybe this was sort of a quote quid pro quo and these kind of arrangements happen all the time. And, you know, first of all, A, it's not unique. Other presidents do this. And B, even if he did it, maybe it wasn't ideal, but it's certainly not impeachable. That they're trying to work in gray areas. The president sees this as black and white. He is saying, I did not do anything wrong. The call was perfect. And I think what you saw today was some efforts. The ranking minority member Nunez really sort of waded into sort of conspiracy theories that weren't particularly effective. The Republican attorney, his questions didn't seem quite as sharp as the Democratic counterparts. They were able to raise some issues. They got some I don't knows. They were able to have Taylor and Kent both suggest, well, I didn't hear that myself. I heard that second and third hand. So there are things that the Republicans will seize upon, but how effective they will be is unclear. And as a final point, I'll just say it's interesting the president's response to this. Though he went on a tweeting and retweeting binge today, he spoke twice to reporters and made a big point out of saying he didn't watch. Mm. That he thought the proceedings were sort of a spectacle and he was very critical of them.
Do you believe him?
I think that the timing was such that he couldn't have watched all of it because he was with the president of Turkey for much of the day. There's no question that he watched at least some in the morning, according to our reporting. I suspect he'll catch up on the highlights tonight when he has a relatively free public schedule. But he is trying to make the argument that he is putting the people's business first, and he's trying to therefore paint the proceedings on Capitol Hill as purely political. Whether that lasts or not, watch his Twitter feed to find out.
But you mentioned the Republican attorney and his questioning. Here's one example of him making the case that the call on July 25th was justified. It was Stephen Castor, he's the attorney, with Ambassador Taylor here, arguing that asking for help with an investigation of Ukrainian involvement in the 2016 election was okay because there is an official U.S. Justice Department inquiry currently underway into whether the Russia investigation got going as a partisan act at that time. Here's Attorney Castor.
So when the president on the call transcript of July 25th raises this with President Zelensky and he urges that there be a connection between the Ukrainian government and the Justice Department officially, I mean, that's the appropriate way to raise an issue with the Ukrainian president, correct?
It's appropriate for the Justice Department and the Prosecutor General to cooperate and to exchange information, yes.
But to the extent the President has concerns and to the extent the Attorney General is having the U.S. Attorney Durham look into that, isn't it entirely appropriate for the President to flag this for President Zelensky and say that you should be in touch with our official channels?
Ms. Castro, I don't know the precise appropriateness of these kinds of relations.
So Ambassador Taylor was squirming a little bit there, one of the few times that he did all day, Andrea. And also it made me think this goes over the head of most Americans right now. But is William Barr's Justice Department investigation into the origins of the Russia investigation in 2016 going to collide with these impeachment hearings at some point to try to establish right from the Justice Department this big old counter narrative?
So there is so much to unpack here. Let's start with the fact that, yes, Taylor sounded kind of flustered, but there is nothing normal about a president of the United States asking a foreign government, which has very serious problems with its own rule of law, to investigate a U.S. citizen. And Taylor made quite clear today in his testimony that this was Trump trying to dominate Ukraine, Trump trying to put them in a box, Trump trying to say to him, you have to go out and publicly say this because I don't trust you to just have an agreement with me. Now, Trump has said in the past that he was concerned about corruption. But in fact, he's only been concerned about the perceived corruption or appearance of conflict by the Biden family and not by all of the corruption, and we haven't really mentioned Rudy Giuliani tonight, but Rudy Giuliani was traveling around Ukraine talking to what both Taylor and Kent today made very clear were corrupt prosecutors in Ukraine. People, a prosecutor who is still there, who U.S. officials thought was so corrupt that they worked with Ukrainians to have a bug installed on his fish tank, in which instance he was caught coaching suspects. So these are very demonstrably corrupt people that were actually working with Rudy and with Bill Barr and with Donald Trump to spread this information. So when you dig into the facts, it presents a contrary picture to the idea of, oh, we just wanted to look into wrongdoing. In fact, they were enabling established perpetrators of wrongdoing who, I'll just add one more nuance to it, have been serving the interests of these oligarchs that have been controlling the Ukrainian government for decades.
It's classic Trump to accuse the other side of doing exactly what he's actually doing.
It is so classic that it's like you get sort of blue in the face kind of trying to rewrite the facts in a situation like this.
And I think kind of further to this point, Sarah in Lower Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, Sarah.
Hi, Brian. Thank you for taking my call. I just have a quick question, and that is, I am wondering if we're going to start hearing the words bribery and extortion more in the context of these hearings. I read a bit in the papers yesterday that this was kind of the direction that the Democrats were going in. Quid pro quo. I'm an attorney, but. And I don't mean to sound condescending in any way about this, but many people don't know what quid pro quo is. And I don't know if I hadn't gone to law school if I would know what it is.
That's right. You're exactly right. And there's been a movement, Andrea, as I'm sure you know, there was maybe the article that Sarah was reading was the one by a number of writers who said, hey, people, you have to stop using the term quid pro quo, which nobody understands, and start using the words bribery and extortion, and I'll throw in blackmail, which, you know, you could make a case that the Trump administration was blackmailing Ukraine, that we were going to hold their necessary security assistance unless they launched these political investigations. And to boot, the word bribery is actually in the Constitution as one of the grounds for impeachment. Are the Democrats going there?
Well, I mean, I think it's worth pointing out this is not a criminal proceeding and that having the president be impeached
but
for high
still,
crimes.
But it's just about clarity of communication.
Right. I mean, it's not. Yes. Although, I mean, even people who are lawyers or close to lawyers get confused about what constitutes bribery, what constitutes government. I think if you pull back what the Democratic case seems to be is you're not allowed to do what Trump did, which is use all the levers of government power for your personal political gain. And that's where they seem to be sticking and not trying to get into the issue of a crime because, as we know, there is an issue that is now headed for the U.S. Supreme Court about whether the president can even be investigated for a crime while he's in office. So the criminal route seems to have been set aside for the time being.
But certainly the politics of it, there is a movement among some Democrats to move away from quid pro quo as a phrase. I actually interviewed Congressman Jim Himes from Connecticut the other day, jokingly asked him what his problem was with Latin. But he just simply said that he feels like that is a term that's confusing for many Americans. They should stick to words like extortion, things that seem to have a little more meaning and a little more depth and more vivid and easier to understand.
We're breaking down today's impeachment hearing and taking your reactions and questions with WNYC's Andrea Bernstein and AP White House correspondent Jonathan Lemire. More in a minute. Brian Lehrer with you on WNYC as we're breaking down today's impeachment hearing and taking your reactions and questions with WNYC's Andrea Bernstein and AP White House correspondent Jonathan Lemire. Our phone number 212-433-WNYC 433-9692. One important excerpt that revealed something new today, and I think this has been breaking out as maybe the biggest news story since this morning. The witnesses were, of course, President Trump's current ambassador to Ukraine, William Taylor, and State Department official George Kent, who oversees U.S.-Ukraine policy. Taylor said that he was told just last Friday by a member of his staff about a conversation that took place on July 26th, the day after the famous Trump-Zelensky phone call.
In the presence of my staff at a restaurant, Ambassador Sondland called President Trump and told him of his meetings in Kyiv. The member of my staff could hear President Trump on the phone asking Ambassador Sondland about the investigations. Ambassador Sondland told President Trump the Ukrainians were ready to move forward. Following the call with President Trump, the member of my staff asked Ambassador Sondland what President Trump thought about Ukraine. Ambassador Sondland responded that President Trump cares more about the investigations of Biden, which Giuliani was pressing for.
So, Jonathan Lemire, that newsworthy story as described by Ambassador Taylor, what do you find new and significant there?
Well, it's a few things. First of all, it is sort of the one – it's an addendum to his opening statement, Ambassador Taylor's. This is new information. He said the staff member only related in the last few days. Staff member has since been identified as David Holmes, who's the political counselor there at the embassy in Kyiv. We don't say Kyiv anymore.
As
of today, we suddenly have changed how we pronounce
it. Because it's the Ukrainian pronunciation, which I learned today.
I don't know. My grandmother, who came from Ukraine, you used to say Kyiv, but Kyiv.
Apparently,
okay.
It's Kyiv now. So this is a moment where it seems to have, you know, an account of the president talking about these investigations he is demanding into the Bidens. And he's talking about it with Ambassador Sondland, who, of course, is very much in the midst of this and will be testifying himself next week. The Republicans sort of push back. This is a moment where I think there was a sense that this was new and damaging. People I talked to in the White House, they did not know this was coming today. This was a moment where they were caught off guard as well. They suggested that it was implausible, that the staff member only remembered it now. Like, why wasn't this part of the record before? We saw Jim Jordan and some of the other congressmen, Jordan, a particularly Trump-friendly Republican, really take some swipes at this account. But I think you asked at the beginning of this show, what was the headline here? The theater or the news? This is the one piece of news that I think has indeed broken through and does appear to be damaging for the president.
And Andrea, Ambassador Sondland, who's referred to in that clip, is scheduled as a witness for a public hearing next week. What's the significance for President Trump, as far as you can tell so far, if Sondland confirms Ambassador Taylor's story about Trump, you know, saying to Sondland on the phone in front of Taylor's staff member who could hear it, that he only cared about the Bidens?
Well, I mean, if that happened, that would be bad, because the defense that somebody just overheard somebody say something would no longer be the case. It would be somebody that actually received the call. It's worth dwelling for a moment on the setting that they're out traveling in Ukraine and the president calls Sondland on a cell phone and someone overhears him speaking, which is itself just a striking scenario for the president of the United States in this unstable part of the world. Sondland's testimony, this testimony was released, was it this week? Was it last week? I can't remember. It feels like years ago. But Sondland's testimony was 375 pages of I don't recall, I don't recall, I don't recall, followed by an addendum letter of I do now recall on September 1st having a conversation in Warsaw about military assistance for in exchange for an investigation. So it's a bit of a mystery what Sondland is going to say next week and exactly what that play was. But Sondland did, in this striking moment, admit, yes, I remember this thing. So I think I am going to be tuning in very carefully to see what he says about that call.
So like Rudy Giuliani and Paul Manafort before them, Paul Manafort and Michael Cohen before them, now Ambassador Sondland and Rudy Giuliani for doing business with Trump might wind up in bigger trouble than Trump does.
You know, it's so resonant because when Michael Cohen went to Congress and he said to the congressman that we're defending Trump, and that were attacking his integrity. He said to them, I was in your position for a decade, and look at me now. I am headed to prison. And it does seem that people around Trump suffer this radioactive fate. Worth dwelling for a moment on Paul Manafort, because he came up sort of indirectly today when Devin Nunes was talking about the Black Ledger and this alleged attempt by the Ukrainians to discredit Trump during the campaign. He was omitting a significant fact, which is that related evidence convicted Paul Manafort in two federal jurisdictions, and he is now serving 7 years in prison. So there's been an attempt to sort of argue relativism, conspiracy theory, nothing is real, who can know? There's a counter set of facts for every set of facts. But according to the American judicial system, no, that's wrong. There was a truth established, and that was that these were in fact misdeeds by Paul Manafort and not an attempt to just discredit Trump during the 2016 election.
Jose in West New York, you're on WNYC. Hi, Jose.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I see a higher degree of importance to the whole impeachment. I think that the Hunter Biden connection is a side deal. It seems to me that there was a direct order to Trump to make sure that Ukraine gets blamed for the 16 election interference, then they get the sanctions and they're removed from Russia, and then Russia will have free reign to encroach even further into Ukraine, and capital will be released, and there could be even other benefits to Trump that may be financial or otherwise. But I think that we may not be connecting all the dots to higher degrees of importance in this entire ordeal.
And you know, Jonathan, I will say, half the calls on our board are one version or another of what does Putin have on Trump that he keeps doing things to benefit Putin?
Well, I asked him that a year and a half ago, and he didn't say, but he also didn't deny it either. He very carefully sort of avoided the question. I think that look, as we were saying earlier, the Russia question is going to will forever shadow how we understand the presidency of Donald Trump. And I think that it is not a surprise that the callers are certainly there. We know that Vladimir Putin, in his conversations with the president, has helped inform his opinion of Ukraine, that the president did believe that the Ukraine was a corrupt nation, that there is, of course, this sort of conspiracy theory in the fever swamps of the right, that Ukraine was indeed behind the 2016 election interference, that the DNC server, the CrowdStrike that we heard a little bit about today, ended up in Ukraine somehow. None of this is true. And in fact, of course, Robert Mueller proved time and time again that it was indeed Russia behind the election interference, even though, of course, Moscow denies it.
He indicted a dozen individual Russians.
He did. By name. Those charges dropped just a few days before the Helsinki summit, in fact, last July.
In some of the testimony, I don't think it came up at the hearings today, but in some of the testimony by the State Department officials, it came up that Trump's views of Ukraine had been shaped by three people: Rudy Giuliani, Vladimir Putin, and Viktor Orban of Hungary, which is chilling when you think about it, that Trump is getting on the phone with these authoritarian world leaders, and they are affecting his foreign policy and the ways he views sovereign nations in Europe.
Well, in fact, to the caller's point about bigger things being at stake, Trump seems to be reestablishing what alliance means in U.S. foreign policy. Instead of with the other democracies of Western Europe and some parts of Asia, it's with other authoritarians anywhere in the world who will support him.
Right. I mean, it's a very situational view where there's an aligning of sort of personal interests and personal relationships and maybe business relationships versus sort of what is in the national interest, what should be the broader American policy in these nations abroad.
Alice in the Bronx, you're on WNYC. Hi, Alice.
Thank you, Brian. Thank you, Andrea. I just must have to say, what is the purpose of the impeachment inquiry if we are not going to remove him? This creature needs to be gone. This can happen for any party, any president. It's wrong for anyone. So it's wrong for him. Now, I listened to the testimony all day today, and it was wonderful. These very qualified people, excellent questions, but these repercussions will occur if he's not removed from office. we're going to have a hard time getting out from under him as it is. I just want to know if you and you all there feel that a simple censure is just not going to be good enough, that we need removal. We have to fire the guy.
Well, that's your opinion, but it doesn't make it happen. I mean, that's the whole point, Andrew, from the Democrats' point of view, of these hearings.
Right.
Today it was these two guys. Friday it's going to be Marie Yovanovitch, who presumably is going to be a very sympathetic character, who was a victim of a smear campaign when she was ambassador to Ukraine under Trump. And they're trying to convince people beyond Alice in the Bronx that it's worth removing him for this.
Right. Well, I mean, I think that the story that we're going to hear on Friday about Ambassador Marie Yovanovitch, and who had was serving and had served under Bush, Trump, and Obama as in the Foreign Service, and was now serving under President Trump, and had been fighting corruption, very vocally fighting corruption in Ukraine, and began to hear these whispers, watch your back. These two associates of Rudy Giuliani are going around Kyiv. They're associating with these corrupt prosecutors. They're trying to get you fired. And then the president's son, Donald Trump Jr., tweeted that she should be fired, and she was indeed fired. So this kind of story, when we hear it on Friday, I think is part of the answer, why do it? Which is, if you don't do it, there's no consequence at all.
And so for the very long-range view, at least potentially, Jonathan, in our last minute, I have this Washington Post story that just dropped during the show while we've been on this hour that says Republican senators are discussing lengthy impeachment trial hearings beginning in January that would scramble the Democratic primaries.
Right, and that's counterintuitive. It runs counter to what we heard before, that Senate Majority Leader McConnell was going to try to do this as quickly as possible, and there would be some motions from senators not to have it at all. This is an interesting calculation, and it'll be interesting to see how this plays out. This certainly would dominate the news cycle in January. I assume, and this is some theorizing here, that they're confident that there will, of course, not be a conviction, that perhaps this would, if the president's going to be acquitted, that this may be not all bad news for him, but hard to say. It certainly keeps Joe Biden and his family in the headlines in a negative fashion. It also removes Democrats who are in the Senate running for president. It keeps them off the campaign trail.
It's a risky gamble because it keeps the Trump impeachment story front and center. Well, thanks to AP White House correspondent Jonathan Lemire and our Andrea Bernstein, co-host of the WNYC ProPublica Trump Inc. podcast and author of the forthcoming book, American Oligarchs, the Kushners, the Trumps, and the Marriage of Money and Power. You can also see Andrea, by the way, as a guest on MSNBC in the 11 o'clock hour tonight. Jonathan there in the 6 a.m. hour tomorrow. He's a trooper. Plus, we invite you to listen to the Brian Lehrer Show tomorrow morning at 10 for more on this, and sign up for the podcast that I'm hosting now called Impeachment, a daily podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Hope this was helpful tonight, folks. Thanks a lot for listening.
Thank you.
Thank you.